I'm Elise Blank, sitting in for John Williams today on the Wintrust Business Lunch. There is a lot of news right now. The market has been very choppy today. Right now, NASDAQ looks to be down about 141 points. It was up just a few moments ago, so it could flip a few more times today before we're done with it. There is some news coming out from Apple issuing new rules for their App Store that will impact streaming game services from Google and Microsoft. So whenever the big tech companies move, it certainly causes the market to shudder just a bit these days. They are such a large part of it. The other thing I wanted to talk about this morning is, or this afternoon, forgot, we're afternoon now, mortgage rates down again this week, the ninth lowest level in history. I'm sorry, I said that. They're now at the lowest level in history, the ninth time this year. It's just, I can't tell you, as somebody who has covered the real estate markets for 20-plus years, it is just incredible to think that when I went and got my first house and my mortgage, my husband and I applied, and the interest rate that we got was 11.75%. 11.75%. You might as well charged it on a credit card. Now, if you want to get a 30-year mortgage, they can be had for about an average of 2.75%. 2.75%. It is almost free. That's the only way to describe it. That number is so low. And a lot of people aren't even getting 30-year loans. If you go with a 15-year loan, that loan would be available for under 2.5%. 2.5%. And a lot of people now are even taking 10-year loans out. So skip the 30-year, skip the 15-year, go for a 10-year loan, and what you might pay is just a little over 2%. So this is really just incredible. I mean, when you think about what it costs you to actually buy a house and how much you pay in interest, if the interest rates are around 7%, which they haven't been in over 25 years, but since the early 90s. But if they were 7% and you took out, let's say, $150,000 loan on your house, that loan, by the time you were done paying it off, would cost you three times that, right? That you'd pay $300,000-$400,000 in interest on the amount of that loan as you're paying it down over 30 years. The way to get a great deal is to actually take the shortest loan term that you can. So now, instead of paying 7% for 30 years, you're going to pay 2 and 3 quarter would be for the 30-year. But let's say you did the 15-year at 2.5%, or let's say you did a 10-year loan at a little over 2%, the amount that you're paying is far less. It's a drop in the bucket. And in terms of building wealth, this is an incredibly good way to do it. So what are we seeing? We're seeing a huge number of Americans that are going and buying houses because they can now afford them with the interest rates as low as they are. They can afford to buy houses, spend 3, 3.5, even 4 times their income. So prices of homes have gone up, but in terms of the number of homes people are buying, we're up well over last year. And last year was a great year in real estate. When it comes to mortgages, we're running about 25% ahead of a year ago, which is just incredible given the economic pain that this country is facing right now. Absolutely amazing. And when you look at people who are refinancing, also those numbers have just been huge. Every time you hear this, that the mortgage interest rates have hit a new low, the mortgage lenders out there jump for joy because it means a whole group of Americans will wake up and say, wow, I'm still paying 4%. I could be paying 2.5%. And they go and they refinance. And that's more cash in your pocket. Now, I will tell you that the downside of these super low interest rates is that nobody wants to give them up. So they don't really want to sell their houses. And one reason that we have so few homes for sale right now is literally because people haven't wanted to give up their mortgages. The houses are cheap to live in, cheaper than if they had to go and buy something else. And it's just amazing to see how these low interest rates have really permeated every facet of our economy. Welcome back to the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm Elise Glink, sitting in for John Williams today. So one of the things that we look at Best Money Moves, my financial wellness technology company, is racial and gender equity. And it turns out that racial equity is tied directly to financial wellness. And part of that is because of centuries of the financial inequity that happened for blacks and people of color. So let me give you some stats before we introduce our guests. The black-white wage gap is an average of 26.5%, and it's increasing. White families have 10 times the net worth of black families. Black families own far fewer homes, 44% versus 73% than whites. They have more mortgage delinquencies, less liquid assets, more student loan debt, and far less savings in retirement. All of these things have contributed to the financial injustice that I think has been pervasive in this country. Karen Freeman Wilson is president and CEO of the Chicago Urban League. She joins us on the line now. Karen, welcome to 720 WGN.
Thank you so much. It's great to be with you today, Elise.
So the statistics that I read, I'm sure they're no surprise to you, right? The Urban League, it really focuses on economic, educational, and social progress for blacks, African Americans, and other minorities. Tell us a little bit about some of the work that you're doing there.
So the Urban League fights for racial and economic justice every day. And so, unfortunately, those statistics were not a surprise. It's really why the League exists and has existed for 104 years. And we do that in a variety of ways. We do it through partnerships with organizations like Wintrust and others, but we also do it through direct programming, through our housing, our Center for Entrepreneurship and Innovation, workforce development, and our work with youth services, our youth development program, and through the work that we do through our impact leadership program that really looks to support the next generation of civic and professional leaders in the black community, but then through our research and policy arm, the arm that actually came up with the epidemic of inequity, structural racism, and COVID-19 in the black community. We published that report back in April because we knew that that COVID-19 was not necessarily causing these inequities, but they were really laying them bare. So we do that through our work in programming, and then we do that through just making folks aware so that they understand the importance of changing many of the policies that have led to the statistics that you laid out. I mean, those statistics, the inequity that you laid out, really has been created by systemic racism policies that have been, in some instances, intentional, and in many instances, unintentional.
So I'm glad you said that. Some of the work that you're doing with small businesses, I think, is really important because, you know, mom and pop shops are on life support right now for the most part, and black businesses in particular are in neighborhoods which have been even harder hit than I think, you know, white neighborhoods. And unfortunately in this community of Chicago, this greater Chicagoland community, we still have some segregated areas. Tell me what the Chicago Urban League is doing to support black businesses, small businesses right now.
Well, the Urban League has been active in this space particularly since March. Initially, it was largely providing advice. How do you access PPP loans? How do you access other support from SBA? What do you need to do to change your approach to business, because we know that your business is shut down? How can we be supportive in terms of technology and marketing and all of the other considerations that most businesses that are larger factor into their budget, but that small businesses have to look to the Urban League and other organizations that support small businesses, like the Women's Business Development Center, to really survive? After March, we began working with the city through their microgrant program and then through their Together Now program, with the state through the BIG program, and very soon with the county and Next Street through a program that they are standing up and that we're working with them and others to stand up through the Chicago Community Trust. And it's twofold. It's getting the grants that will literally help you survive, and it's also providing the advice and technical assistance to help you continue. And not just continue barely subsisting, but also to continue and grow your business. You know, what are the things that customers need in this pandemic? But more importantly, as we hear corporations like the Hyatt, like McDonald's, like others, say that they want to do business with small businesses, that they want to get them into their supply chains, that they want to give black businesses a chance, how do you enter into those supply chains in a way that will allow you to benefit from a new approach that many businesses are taking, and quite frankly, a new approach that a lot of governmental entities are taking, the state, the feds. We know that the state buys literally everything, and so often the city buys a lot of the services or procures a lot of the services and goods that are provided by small businesses. How do you get into those pipelines to grow your business so that when the next disruption comes, and, you know, God forbid it should be a pandemic, but we know that business is cyclical. When that next cycle comes, you're better able to withstand that.
Which is so important. How is it that people can apply for these programs, Karen? Where should they reach out?
They can reach out on our, we have a COVID-19 website, culcovid19.com, but you can also look on the city, on the state's website. The city, the state rather, is preparing for another round of grants to businesses. And so I would say to stay on the DCEO website for the city so that folks will know. But the other place that I would look is on the county's website, because the county is just starting their program now. So there will be an opportunity there as well.
Terrific. Karen Freeman Wilson is president and CEO of the Chicago Urban League. You can find out more from them, chiul.org. Karen, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having us.
ThinkGlink.com, thinkglink.com. Sign up for my free weekly newsletter talking about real estate and personal finance topics. If you're interested in financial wellness for your business, go to bestmoneymoves.com. That newsletter comes out on Thursdays, looks at all of the news going on in the financial wellness world, and good tips as well for how to handle your benefits for open enrollment. Chris Salviati joins me on the line now. He is the housing economist at Apartment List. He conducts research on economic trends in the housing market. Chris, welcome to WGN.
Hi, Lee. Thanks for having me on.
It's nice to have you on. So I saw some statistics today that the number of renter households unable to pay rent is actually, as a share of total renter households, is a lot higher in some cases than I thought. In Illinois, one of the statistics that I saw showed that 42% of renter households have been unable to pay rent in July and August. That seems so high to me. Is that the number that you're seeing as well?
Yeah, so we have, in our survey, we're seeing definitely a really elevated rate of late payments. And so when this is a survey that we've been running since the start of the pandemic in April, and we've been seeing, we've run this survey in the first week of every month, and we've been finding that roughly a third of renters in the first week of the month are not making their full rent payment. I will kind of contextualize that a bit, though, by saying that we do also ask about prior month rent in each of these surveys, and we find that most of these payments that are being missed at the beginning of the month do get made up with late payments throughout the remainder of the month. So as of the first week of September, we found that just 10% of renters had failed to make their August rent payments. And so, you know, even though these first week numbers are, I would say, pretty alarming, a lot of those do kind of get made up with late payments. But that said, even these late payments are indicative of folks who are struggling financially, and we're really seeing renters kind of making a lot of financial sacrifices just to scrape by.
Yeah, we've been hearing from people through the show today and even earlier in the show talking about, you know, the troubles that they're having paying and, you know, the eviction moratoriums that are out there. And then, of course, landlords who have trouble on the other side, because when your tenant isn't paying you, sometimes it's really hard to turn around and make that payment to your own lender. So people are starting to be in danger of, I think, losing their properties. Let's talk, though, for a moment more about this, you know, the people who are able to catch up. So I know that when you look at this, it's not generally mom and pop rentals that you're looking at, right? These are sort of larger companies that own thousands and thousands of units, or am I mistaken about that?
So it's a combination. We're looking at kind of both segments of the market there. I guess we've got, you know, I'll clarify, I guess, that apartment list as kind of a product. Our site does have, you know, a kind of higher share of those large multifamily properties, but for this particular survey, we're doing this in collaboration with SurveyMonkey, which is helping us draw a broader representative sample to get more of those mom-and-pop type properties in here as well. We are seeing, actually, that when we break this up by property type, the rate of late payments and missed payments is actually a bit higher for those mom-and-pop landlords than it is in kind of the big multifamily properties, which, again, you know, in a lot of these cases, those mom-and-pop landlords are the ones that are operating on pretty thin margins, and so, you know, when those folks aren't able to have their tenants paying rent on time, that can definitely, you know, impact their ability to make their mortgage payments.
Now, we just had on the CEO, president and CEO of the Chicago Urban League, which in Chicago and the metropolitan area focuses on black households and what's, you know, how to help them and black-owned businesses. But you found in one of your surveys, or maybe it's every survey that you're doing, that there is the pandemic has really exacerbated long-standing concerns around financial instability and housing insecurity among racial lines as well. Share with us what you're seeing in terms of unpaid rent for black and Hispanic households.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So one of the kind of big indicators that we're looking at in this survey is the share of folks who are starting the month with unpaid rent from a prior month. And we find that this month, 31% of renters overall started September with unpaid rent that they owed their landlord from one of the earlier months this year. But that was something that varied significantly by race. So among the white renters that we surveyed, that share was 24%, so well below that average. Whereas for black renters, it was 41%, and Hispanic renters, even higher than that, 48%. And so, you know, really those rates for black and Hispanic renters are nearly double the rate for white renters, which is really troubling. I think, you know, in a lot of cases, minority renters tend to be more likely to work in the service occupations that have really been hit very hard by the, you know, the pandemic and the layoffs and furloughs that have accompanied the social distancing guidelines. And so this is really, you know, kind of, as you said, exacerbating what have been longstanding inequities in the housing market.
Chris, I'd love to ask you a little bit more about, you know, what people are giving up. You sort of mentioned this a little bit earlier, and there's significant sacrifices. We have to take a short break, but I hope you'll stick with us. Chris Salviati is a housing economist at Apartment List, and he does research in economic trends. Stay tuned for more with Chris coming up in just a moment. But right now, here's Steve Grzanich with the Wintrust Business Minute.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Northwestern Medicine and Palos Health are working on a merger. Crane says the two have signed a letter of intent for Palos to join Northwestern Medicine. The deal is subject to regulatory approval and must be okayed by their boards. The deal would be Northwestern's first expansion into the southwest suburbs. Chicago-based parking app Spot Hero has agreed to acquire Canadian company Rover Parking as it expands its footprint in North America. The acquisition will help it gain access to thousands of parking spots across Canada. Coca-Cola is investing in Pour My Beer, a Chicago startup that creates a system that allows bars to offer self-serving taps. The investment will allow the company to expand into Europe. Chicago Innos is the investment arm of Coca-Cola European Partners, has acquired a 25% stake in Innovative Tap Solutions, the company behind Pour My Beer. Pour My Beer's technology allows people to pour their own drinks at bars and restaurants and pay by the ounce. The startup says it operates more than 7,000 taps at bars, restaurants, casinos, and hotels worldwide. United Airlines has announced new service to Africa, India, and Hawaii. Starting in December, the airline will offer daily flights from Chicago to New Delhi. Next year, United will add service from San Francisco to Bangalore, India, Newark to Johannesburg and Washington, D.C., to Ghana and Nigeria. It also plans new flights to Kona and Maui in Hawaii. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Welcome back to the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm Elise Glink, sitting in for John Williams today. I actually have the pleasure of spending a little time with you next week as well. Pete Zimmerman, our producer, and I will come up with some great things, but I'll be around next Thursday and next Friday, filling in for John as he takes a little bit of time off and enjoys what we hope will be good weather for him. It's really awful to take off a day and then it's like cold and rainy and snowy, but I guess it's, you know, it's still nice. We've got Chris Salviati. He's a housing economist at Apartment List on the phone with us. We've been talking about trends with rent and how many people are paying their rent and not paying their rent. And, Chris, you said something early in our conversation about how people who are keeping up with the rent, which just requires, like, huge sacrifices for them in other areas. And we got a sense of that earlier in the show when a guy called in and said that his landlord who lives, his landlord's like one of these big companies that is out of state, hadn't paid the water bill, and they got a notification, the water bill is supposed to be included in the rent, from their local municipality. They were going to shut off the water, and he was trying to find $350 with his other tenant in the building to be able to keep the water on. So tell us what your research is showing.
Yeah, so we're definitely seeing significant financial sacrifices that folks are making, particularly those who are behind on their rent. So, you know, obviously a significant share kind of cutting their spending, but that's, you know, actually across the board, even maybe folks who aren't necessarily struggling with their rent, just by the virtue of, you know, everything kind of lots of things being closed. I think a lot of people have just, like, had their spending cut naturally. So when we're thinking about, you know, the sacrifices that people are making, we're really looking at some of these more extreme measures, things like drawing from your savings or borrowing from family, friends, even selling assets. And we find that all of these things are really common among renters who started the month with unpaid rent debt. 41% have drawn money from their savings account. 40% have borrowed from family or friends. 31% have sold a personal asset, such as a car or an investment, that sort of thing. 30% are accumulating new debt on credit cards. and actually 16% have drawn money from a retirement account, which is, you know, as you know, pulling money from a retirement account usually has pretty significant early withdrawal penalties associated with it. So that's really something that you would do only under the most extreme circumstances. And so I think, you know, the fact that 16% of renters with debt are doing that is definitely indicative of you know, what the extreme measures that they're taking just to get by. And I would say also that each of these kind of forms of financial sacrifice that I just mentioned are also pretty common among the renters who started the month without unpaid rent debt, which is really indicating that, you know, even those folks that have managed to keep up with their rent, are a lot of them are having to make sacrifices to do that. You know, when we kind of, if you aggregate all of those different types of sacrifice that I just mentioned together, it's 82% of those that started the month with a rent debt have made at least one or more of those types of sacrifices.
Right. I just have to say, Chris, that it just feels unsustainable to me. You know, it's one thing, you know, most Americans, 40% of them don't even have $400 in savings. And to have gone through month after month of maybe job loss, more than half of all households in the country have lost income. So whether it's losing a job or they've been, you know, furloughed or whatever it is, lost hours, taking pay cuts, you know, that's a huge percentage. But now if you're already reaching in, and such a big percentage is reaching into savings and selling things that they own, and now, you know, 401ks, I mean, when does that, you know, pretty soon you're going to run out of those things to sell, and then what?
Yeah, no, I think you're definitely right that this is certainly a pretty troubling situation with a lot of folks who are really operating at the edge of their financial means right now. I think one thing that I guess is maybe a very slight bright spot is that we actually saw the numbers improve very slightly this month compared to last month, and that was a bit of a surprise, because obviously the expanded unemployment benefits that have been provided through the CARES Act have since expired, and so we were really expecting that this month we would really see a notable worsening in these numbers, and instead there was, you know, only a couple of percentage points, but a very slight improvement in the number of folks that were able to make their rent on time this month. And so I do think, you know, the kind of the gradual reopening and, you know, the fact that we are seeing some of these furloughed and laid off employees getting back to work is definitely good news. And I think there is signs of some very slow improvement, but it's definitely not going to be that sharp V-shaped recovery that a lot of folks were talking about at the beginning of the pandemic, and there's definitely going to be a lot of folks struggling for some time to come. I guess one other piece of a little bit of kind of, I don't know if silver lining is quite the right term to use here, but we are also seeing that landlords are pretty willing to be flexible with their tenants. We find that, you know, among these renters who are having difficulty paying rent, a lot of them are asking their landlords if they can renegotiate their lease or work out some form of payment plan. And in the majority of those cases, landlords are willing to negotiate. And, the renters that have made those inquiries, 3 out of 4 say that they have either reached a new agreement or are in the process of negotiating. And so I think, you know, right now, landlords, it's obviously a time where rents are falling and there's, you know, a lot of uncertainty. If you were to kind of lose your tenant, if you would be able to fill that vacancy again and how long that would take. And so we are seeing that landlords are really willing to be flexible in a lot of cases.
Which is really great news. Chris Salviati is the housing economist at Apartment List. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Thanks, Elise. Nice talking to you.
We'll talk to you again soon.